So I'm going to start quite generally and say I did do some research for this talk, and I think that there is a great deal of evidence that people who have some sort of religious or spiritual practice are happier than other people. They live longer, they're healthier, their marriages last longer, and they suffer from fewer serious mental health issues like depression. One interesting piece of research that I read was a meta-survey of a man who'd looked at about 4,000 different surveys done in the last 20 or 30 years in an attempt to try to explain what is the link between happiness and spirituality. And he came up with an interesting finding, I thought, which was that happiness and spirituality are two standalone things which are linked together in some way. But they are neither of them a kind of subset of the other. So what you could say, for instance, that we might want more money because we believe that it would make us happier. We might want to take exercise because we believe it would make us happier. We might want to go for a walk in the country. We might even want to get married. But we do not enter onto a spiritual path or commit ourselves to a religion because we believe it will make us happier. We commit to a spiritual path or a religion as a thing in itself, for the sake of the thing itself. And so therefore, you cannot say, so spirituality in the factors that contribute towards happiness has a different kind of a place. And this concords very much with what, say, for instance, is said within the Islamic mystical tradition, that you enter upon the spiritual path for the love of God, for love, not because you want to get anything out of it for yourself. And so the order of love is a different order. I mean, we don't fall in love because we think someone will make us happy. In actual fact, we often fall in love with people who make us deeply unhappy. But but the fact of the matter is that in falling in love, in the experience of love, in some way we are made supremely happy in many cases. So, and nobody, what's interesting about this is that although these statistics come out that there is this link between these two things, it remains a little bit mysterious about exactly what is the link between these two things. And I'm not going to at all attempt to explain it in this talk. So please don't think that I am. My approach really in thinking about how to talk about happiness in this spirituality in this context was that I found a thing called Action for Happiness, which is a kind of big movement in the modern day, which is kind of 10 things, 10-point plan to increase our happiness. And it has this charming little acronym called the Great Dream to allow us to remember the 10 different factors, which are simply giving, relating, exercising, appreciating, trying out new things, having a direction, having resilience, having emotions, acceptance of yourself, and the 10th one, meaning, which they define as being part of something bigger than ourselves. And this, the last one, is where I thought I saw an entrance for talking about spirituality. Because what they have in mind, they say, get out there and join a campaign group, get involved with your community. But actually, it occurred to me that being involved with a reality greater than ourselves is actually the very essence of spirituality and of religion. And we may call this reality God, or we may call it the truth, or we may call it the real or the one. And I asked Rod, and he said, you'd call it the big mind. Yes, within Buddhism. But these are all ways of referring to a reality which is not only a little bit bigger or a little bit more powerful than we are, but actually is ultimately larger, in that, you know, all the traditions would agree that when we're referring to God, truth, real, or the big mind, we're referring to something which is actually infinite, something which is limitless and without boundaries. And Ibn Arabi refers to it as an ocean without a shore, meaning that no matter how much knowledge we gain of it, no matter how high we fly, or no matter how deep we go, we will never, ever come to the end of this. And thinking about being part of this reality, this greater reality, makes us happy, because even though we might think of ourselves as small and finite and limited in our physical constitution, there is in fact something within us which belongs to this realm of the infinite, for which this realm is our homeland. And therefore, we yearn or we long to have contact with it. And in the Western tradition, we would call this probably spirit, our spirit or our heart. And I think in Buddhism, you would call it the mind, would you? Yeah. So the core kind of saying for this talk, really, is a Quranic saying which says, I'm taking Arabic, إِلَّا بِذِكْرِ اللَّهِ تَتَمَنُوا الْقُلُوبُ. Only in the remembrance of God are the hearts satisfied. And so we could say only in the remembrance of the truth or the one, or even in the remembrance of the great mind, are the hearts satisfied. And this verb tamana, which is translated as to be satisfied, to be pacified, or to be at peace, has a meaning of it of low-lying water. It's water that has found its level and which has found a low place to rest and which is therefore settled, unagitated, at peace. So it has a meaning of rest after motion. And so we would say that the heart is restless because of its longing for a contact with something. We know that we desire something. We know that we need something to assuage our sense of aloneness or our sense of separation, but we don't know what it is. So we search for it in all sorts of places which actually cannot satisfy it. We search for it in money, in sex, in power. And as we heard yesterday, these days, it seems that we search for it by shopping. All of which are what are referred to in the tradition as substitutes. These are all substitutes because they are not the real thing. There are things that we are looking for, are substituting for what we're really looking for. And the result of this is this restlessness and this constant motion moving from thing to thing. And I thought that this is exactly what we were talking about last night when we were talking about addiction. Do you know the people who just keep searching and searching? They're looking for something, but they're looking in the wrong place, basically. So this saying, you know, only in the remembrance of God are the hearts satisfied, is this kind of moment where one realizes, one finds what it is that's really going to satisfy this longing. And so there's a sense of, oh, settled. Yes, here we are. At last, here is something, you know. So this yearning for something greater than us is actually, I think, so intrinsic to our nature that in the modern day it's coming into in a realm where few people actually believe in God or any kind of greater spiritual reality. It's actually coming into the secular realm. And so there's this strange phenomenon growing up of what's called secular churches, and which is a big movement which is really growing with hundreds of people attending in London now. And I had an interview on the radio last Thursday with one of the people who's organising this, and she said, oh, we don't want anything to do with God or anything like that, but we like to come together, you know, and we want to acknowledge, have a sense of something that's greater than ourselves. And what they do is, she said, and what we do is we give praise and thanks. So the people are meeting for these services because this is such a great need for us. And there's this other phenomenon which perhaps is very interesting, which is secular prayer. And so there are lots of people who say, no, I don't believe in God or anything like that, but I do like to pray, do you know? And so at times of great difficulty, they will find themselves addressing a prayer. And this, again, is a strange phenomenon, but it indicates this longing that we have. The word actually in Arabic that's usually used for happiness is saada. And it has two different lines of meaning, which I want to look at both of them now, and hopefully we will get through it. And the first one is that saada is to do with paradise. And the Sa'id are the happy people who achieve salvation and go to heaven. And so in the Quranic tradition, the Sa'id are often described as people who have happy, shining, smiling faces. And of course, the opposite, the people who go to hell have black, non-expansive, pinched faces. And the other meaning, and this, I'm going to have a go at this word, is a word that came up a lot yesterday, eudaimonia, which is the Aristotelian concept of happiness. And this came into the mystical philosophy of Islam, and it is, Saada is the direct translation of eudaimonia in that tradition. And it has a meaning that various meanings, which I think you said was the flourishing of the, it refers to the flourishing of the human soul. And yesterday we had it defined as long-term happiness rather than short-term happiness of immediate gratification. And in the mystical tradition, it's most usually translated or anything is that it's to do with the fulfillment of human potential. And this, I'm glad to see that we already touched upon this morning in what came out of the first discussion. So eudaimonia is to do with striving to become what we really are, to really become the best that we can be. And it's linked in the Islamic tradition to what's called the concept of the insan al-kamil, which is the concept of the complete or perfected human being. So to go first to the concepts of paradise. So a very simplistic view of this concept of Saada and paradise is, you know, that we are in this physical world now, and we will enter the spiritual world when we die. And this has been a very, very prominent view of the religions for many thousands of years, in which we see this world that we're in now as merely an anteroom of the world that's to come. And it leads to what one would say was a kind of social quietism, meaning that we don't have to worry about the conditions in this world and what's happening in this world. This is a place of suffering, it's a place of grief, it's a place of imperfection, and we put up with this because when we die we will go to heaven and we will be rewarded, yes, and enter into the state of complete happiness afterwards. And this, you know, this attitude that led Marx to call religion the opiate of the people, meaning, and you know, that mean that it stops people engaging with the present and with their conditions. And it's a sad fact that most improvements in the human condition materially have come about through secular movements and not through religious movements, precisely because of this. But I think we make it clear that this is not the attitude that we have here. And in the mystical traditions, it's a very different picture, in that the mystical tradition of Islam, which I know best, does not make the same separation between the two worlds, this world and the world, the spiritual world. And in fact, one of the most sort of important sayings within the mystical tradition is the saying, die before you die, meaning enter into the spiritual world while you're still living in this world. And it's an affirmation of this possibility. So within this view, these two worlds are in some way intermingled, or they are coexistent, and they are known to be two aspects of a single reality. Not we are here and then we're there, but that we can be simultaneously, or, you know, at the same time, these two worlds are present. And so within the mystical tradition, you would say these idea of heaven and hell are known to be more, not states that we enter to into after death, but to do with the states and attitudes of mind that we have in the here and now, in the present. Going back to our basic quotation, the question of remembrance has a very, very important place in this, because remembrance is understood not just to be a merely intellectual or even imaginative matter, but it's understood that through this remembrance is the bringing about of the presence of this realm to us, so that it is in the realm of experience and taste. And so the two sayings are things like, these are divine sayings, remember me and I will remember you. which indicates that when we remember this greater reality, then we are included in it. And the other, which Ibn Arabi loves very much, which is, I am the companion of the one who remembers me. And there are very different levels of this question of remembrance. It's in practice within Islamic mysticism. It has a practice. It's a practice that's done communally, with sort of people participating in the saying of the divine names of God. It's a fundamental practice which would be given, say, to an initiate, to repeat these words or the names of God or a phrase from the Quran like La ilaha illallah, constantly, to develop this constant remembrance. And at his higher level, it is actually to do, or the most fundamental level, it's not even to do with a spoken remembrance, but it's simply to do with a state of awareness in the heart, a constant orientation in which there is, while we're in this world, a constant awareness of the presence of this next world as well, the spiritual world as well, which is, of course, cultivated in practice such as meditation and prayer. And we say that what's meant by presence here is not really being in a transcendent state, do you know, so that we're kind of whisked away from this world in a state of ecstasy, although sometimes it can seem like this, but is a state where you might say there is what you might call an intersection of these two worlds in the present moment. So in Sufi terminology, this moment is called the waqt, the present moment that we're in. And it's often translated, you would say, this is the eternal now. So this is the present moment, which is also this awareness of the eternal and the unlimited present now. And it seems to me that many of the experiences which have been very moving that people related yesterday were actually of this nature, of a moment when suddenly there's a sense of a grace or a beauty or a sense of immensity or a sense of love suddenly kind of comes into our mundane experience and produces in us really a state of intense happiness because of this. This sense of companionship, I wanted to say a couple of... Oh, my God. Okay. 2 minutes, sorry. I'm going to finish this section, even if I run over a little bit. So, there are two aspects to the sense of companionship. And one is that within a theistic tradition like Islam, there is a sense of personal relationship. So the sense of the companion is like the companionship of a person. And so the most common way that the God is referred to within the Sufi tradition is the friend of all the ways that we'd have of those connotations of being loved, of being supported, of being accepted, and of not being alone. And then there was a sense in which I would say, was a non-personal sense of companionship, which is that this is companionship with the spirit which underpins the created world. So it's the spirit which is the reality of every created thing in the world. So in this sense, there is a sense of being at one with the world and everything in it, of belonging to it and of not being alienated from it. And, you know, this is why for many Sufi mystics, like I think many Buddhist teachers, there are lots of stories of them speaking to animals and interacting with other beings, beings in the universe. It's a very big stone tradition in Islam of the Sufi saints interacting with stones. Yeah. So I want to finish. I'm determined to say this one. So thinking about this aspect of Sada, there was one thing that came up and I thought about yesterday in the conversation with about Robert McAlpine, is to, what are the conditions of happiness? What are the conditions? Because if we don't think of spiritual happiness as happening somewhere else or later, but here and now, then there is a question of what are the condition, the physical condition in which this can happen to us or how it can be cultivated. And the reason I want to get to this bit is that I want to talk here about Akong Rinpoche, who was a Tibetan master who most people here will know was the abbot of Sami Ling just outside Edinburgh for many years, and who died in rather distressing circumstances just recently. And this has been so he's in all our minds at the moment. And several years ago, actually, I had the privilege of interviewing Akong Rinpoche about his healing work. And I had the privilege of having something like, I think, a 2-hour one-to-one conversation with him, which I must say for me was a very great education and a very great blessing. One of the things that Akong Rinpoche talked about was the work that he's done all over the world on poverty. And so he was doing this when he was killed recently. He has expended a huge amount of effort on feeding people, finding medicine for them, finding them warm clothes, relieving their distress. And he said, the reason I'm doing this, is what he told me, he said, the reason I'm doing this is not because, it's not for their physical well-being, it's for their spiritual well-being. Because he said, when people are dominated by their physical needs, when they are in such a state of distress, they cannot turn their mind towards towards spiritual development and towards fulfilling their potential. And he told me that, of course, he had experienced this because he had escaped from Tibet over the Himalayas under very, dire circumstances, and they had experienced the most dreadful hunger. I mean, they had almost starved to death. And he had experienced in himself that even though he was an enlightened Rinpoche, he was completely cut off from that spiritual reality while the demands of the body were so great. So what he saw was the need for this work with fulfilling the physical needs to a satisfactory level is a precondition for preparing people for a spiritual realization. And in this way, I think spirituality, this question of spirituality, connects very clearly with the much more practical kind of economic and political aims of these movements. I'm sorry to go over my time.